Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michala Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27.
In today's episode, I'm really pleased to be in conversation with Zoe Adams-Green. Zoe, could I just ask you to give a brief introduction to yourself?
Yes, of course. Hi there. So I'm 43 and at present I live in Rome with my Italian husband and our little boy. He's going to be turning two in a couple of weeks' time, in fact. But I've actually lived all over the European Union. I spent 12 years in Spain and 5 years in Germany. And I've also had a couple of shorter periods in a couple of other countries as well. So I'm very, very involved in the European project. I feel truly European.
I mean, obviously, you're the kind of living and breathing example of this kind of use of free movement to move around Europe quite extensively. But it isn't necessarily what people think about when they think about migration, because very often they think about it as like this one-off move, moving from one place to the next. So I wonder if you could give a little bit more of a sense of what kind of motivated those movements and your experience of them.
Yes, of course. I think it's also important to point out that freedom of movement does work both ways. And in a lot of cases, people think that there's lots and lots of foreigners coming over to the UK and that we don't have that reciprocal right, or that not many people use that right. And in my case, when I was growing up, I went on the German exchange with my school. And that's when I really fell in love with the European Union for the first time. And that meant that I was open to different opportunities. And when I finished university, I knew that I wasn't restricted to the UK labour market. And what actually happened is that I was looking for a job in London. And I realised that the wage really wasn't a living wage for the London area. So I looked further afield and I found a job in Germany. And I then spent 5 years working in-house as a translator for SAP in Baden-Württemberg. So after I'd finished my 5 years there, I'd got enough experience to set myself up as a freelancer. And I decided to start my own translation company. In the meantime, my mum had used her freedom of movement and she'd moved to Spain. So at that point, I thought, OK, do I want to move back to the UK? That was where my dad was living and my sisters. Or do I want to move to Spain and give that a go? And I decided I'd move to Spain to be near my mum. And I stayed there for 12 years. At the end of that period in my life, I was lucky enough to meet my now husband. And it was, again, really, really easy for me to just up sticks and go and establish myself in Italy. And that's something that's actually really difficult for a self-employed person to do. If they're not an EU citizen, they have to get a self-employment permit. And that's really difficult. They're like gold dust. So that's how I ended up where I am now. And I'm sure that that would not have happened if it hadn't have been for freedom of movement. And in actual fact, I'm pretty sure that my son wouldn't have been born if it weren't for freedom of movement.
I think that's really fascinating. There are a couple of things I just wanted to pick up on a bit. The first is this being in love with the EU. I think quite often, certainly in the work that I'd done previous to Brexit, when you spoke with British citizens who lived in, for example, France or Spain, they'd tell you about their love of the place that they were living, which I think is quite different to kind of being in love with the EU. And the other thing that I really wanted to, hear a little bit more about is this sense in which what's really clear is that the ease that freedom of movement permitted in terms of moving, trying something out, settling, is really something that's helped your life in lots of ways. But yes, I do think it's not an unusual story, but it isn't the story that we hear most regularly.
No, it isn't. And again, there's this big myth about everyone, all the Brits that live in Europe in the European Union, being pensioners, living off their retirement funds. And in actual fact, that's not the case at all. And I was able, without doing anything in advance, I was able to just move to these different countries and then set myself up. And that's the real difference. Of course, third country nationals can still move to the EU. That is possible, but they have to meet national immigration laws and they're always stricter than they are for EU citizens.
Yeah, I think you're really highlighting what that freedom from constraint can permit and the opportunities that it affords to the people who are able to take those up because they're released from those constraints. I mean, I suppose there's a little bit of a further backstory to this, which is that your degree, as I understand it, was a language degree as well.
Yes, it's German and Russian.
But of course, you're not living in a country where either of those languages are the common language. But I guess that also gave, you know, I guess it's all related to the story about that exchange that you went on when you were at school and your experiences through university as well.
Yes, I really think it is. And those experiences, as I was growing up, just gave me a broader outlook. And I think that's such an important thing to have. And I really did feel that the EU was my oyster. I felt I could go anywhere that I wanted. When I originally started looking for that job after university, I just took it for granted.
Yeah, I really like that idea of the EU being your oyster. It really appeals to me in lots of ways. And I think what it helps to communicate as well is that I suppose after those first few experiences, you were not really daunted at all at the prospect of moving around the EU.
No, I really wasn't. It seemed like moving somewhere else that was home to me already.
Sorry to kind of keep going back to this, but this idea of loving the EU, I think, is the thing that kind of holds that together. And it's kind of the excitement about, I suppose, that shared project that you're communicating.
Yeah, and it's also the fact that there's a lot of diversity in the EU. The countries aren't the same by a long way. So you can experience all of that diversity, but you can do it without lots of bureaucracy. And that's something that I really appreciated. And I'm really sad that future generations of Brits aren't going to have that opportunity.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, when we were speaking in our pre-chat about 6 weeks ago now, you talked about being a true European. And I wondered if you could kind of, because that's the kind of identity side of it, rather than, you know, just your relationship to Europe. What does it mean to you to say that you are a true European?
Well, I think one of the reasons that I feel like that is because I've now spent almost 20 years outside of the UK, and I've had all of those influences acting upon who I am now. So I have been extremely fortunate there. And also, I've got this family of people who are in a similar situation to me now. So I would say that I feel closer to some of the people that I've met through my Brexit campaigning than I do to people that I've known my entire life, because we've got this shared background and this shared love and appreciation of the EU. So it really is a very important part of my life. I spend a lot of time on it as well. I guess you could say that Brexit has taken my life over to a certain extent. I think my husband would probably say so. But it's something, because I do feel so passionate about it, I've been happy to put in that time, first trying to campaign to stop Brexit, and now focusing on preserving as many of our citizens' rights as possible.
And I suppose that works as quite a good kind of bridge into the conversation about Brexit, because you've been deeply involved in advocacy work about the future rights of British citizens living in the EU ever since the referendum through your work with British in Europe. But part of that, as I've kind of discussed with various of your colleagues from British in Europe and various other people, is to do with how Brexit changes the terms on which you're living in Europe at the moment. But I think that one of the things that you're particularly concerned about is the kind of far-reaching and long-standing consequences of Brexit for people like you living in Europe. Do you want to explain that a little bit more?
Yes, I mean, there's a couple of things that concern me, two main areas. One of those things is my right to return and, for instance, help my parents as they get older, if they need me to. And there's various issues at stake there. At the moment, I've only been living in Italy for a few years, and that means that I'm classed as an ordinary resident underneath the terms of the withdrawal agreement. What that basically means is that I can only be absent for 6 months in any one-year period. And if I'm absent for longer, then I break my residency. So technically, I can come back at any time because I'm the spouse of an Italian citizen. But if I did that, I'd start my residency from scratch and I'd lose some of the protections under the withdrawal agreement. So an example of that would be I would lose family reunification rights. So that would mean that I'm restricted at the moment in how long I can go back and look after my parents if they need me to do so. Even after I've attained permanent residency, so that's after I've been here 5 years, I've then got the problem that I can't just take my husband back with me because he's Italian. In that case, he would only be allowed to be in the UK for a limited period of time, or I'd have to establish myself over in the UK, and then I'd have to apply to bring him over under the UK immigration rules for third country nationals. The UK government has actually given us an exemption from those rules until March 2022. But, you know, my parents aren't that old yet, so I'm thinking that I might need, you know, I might need to think about this, say, in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, who knows? So that's one of the things that concerns me, and I think a lot of people are in that position. Another issue for me is the fact that maybe I would have liked to have had the chance to retire to the UK. And again, I've then got to jump through the hoops at that time to take my husband with me. Then on the other hand, as a mother, I'm concerned about my son and his rights in the future. And I'm sure a lot of people think, oh, you know, her son's a dual national and he's got to be one of the luckiest people in the EU at present. And from a certain point of view, that is true, because of course he has the right to live and work in the UK, and he has the right to live and work in all of the EU27 because he's an Italian citizen by birth as well. But there are a lot of things that have been forgotten when people think about the withdrawal agreement and our rights. They think everything's been covered, and it hasn't. For instance, in my case, I'd always hoped that my son would be able to have the chance to go to university in the UK, if that's the way that he was going, you know, if he decided he wanted to go to university, and perhaps experience UK culture, because we live in Italy, you know, we're not planning on going anywhere soon, so he's going to grow up in Italy, and I wanted him to get to know that side of his heritage as well. And the problem there is that the UK government has granted us home fees for courses that start within 7 years of the end of the transition, and my son's too. So, you know, do the maths. He's a clever little boy, but he's not going to be going to university at the age of 9. So that means that he's going to have to pay international fees. And just to give people an example, I actually checked on the figures at my old university, which is the University of Bath. So home fees for courses starting in 2020 are £9,250. And international fees range from £18,000 to £22,300, depending on the discipline. So if you look at an average 3-year course, that's basically 30 grand that parents are going to have to come up with in addition. And I don't think UK fees are particularly cheap in the first place. You know, this is a lot of money. And effectively, that's going to rule out a lot of British children, children who are British from birth, from going to university in the UK when they reach that age. I think that's disgusting.
I think that both of those examples really clearly illustrate what some of the problems are and will be if things aren't addressed sooner.
Yeah, this is a really important point. I'd just like to add something there if I can, because we're looking at the very long picture. And that issue is how people are going to prove in, say, 20 years' time that they're entitled to some of the social security provisions of the withdrawal agreement. Because as a Brit living in Italy, I can go and get a special document that says that I'm covered underneath the withdrawal agreement, so that I have the protections in the withdrawal agreement. But it's looking very much as if dual citizens can't get that document. Now, dual citizens are also entitled to things like pension upgrading for life. So in 20 years' time, how is a dual citizen who is otherwise in my situation going to prove to the Department of Works and Pensions that they're able to get that uprated pension under the withdrawal agreement? Nobody can answer that question at the moment, and a lot of my friends are really worried about this issue. The problem is that it's a residency document, and an Italian citizen is able to reside in Italy by virtue of being Italian. So they can't get this document saying that they're able to reside in Italy through virtue of the withdrawal agreement, because it's irrelevant to them that they're Italian citizens. They already have that right. So, you know, and this is the same situation throughout the EU. There's going to be this subset of people who are entitled to the provisions of Title 3 of the withdrawal agreement on social security coordination, but who aren't covered by Title 2, which is the residency, because they're dual citizens. And it's totally unclear at the moment how they are going to attest to their rights for social security coordination in, say, 20 or 25 years' time when it comes time for them to draw their pension.
As I said, anticipating potential problems is a way of hopefully stopping them. That said, one of the things that you are in the process of doing at the moment is applying for Italian citizenship. Obviously, you've already got your residence. And my understanding, and I think actually what you've just said really does highlight this, that this doesn't necessarily resolve the issues related to being a British citizen in Italy at the point of withdrawal. So I suppose my question is, what does applying for Italian citizenship do for you? But also, what does it leave unresolved for you?
Well, the main thing that it does for me is that it gives me political rights again, so I'd be able to vote. At the moment, because I've been out of the UK for more than 15 years, I don't have a vote anywhere. Political rights were lost immediately upon the withdrawal of the UK from the European Union. It's the one thing that we didn't keep during transition. So that means that immediately I lost my vote in, for instance, European elections in Italy. And as I said, I'd already lost my right to vote in the UK. So that means that, in fact, again, there's this subset of people who are subject to taxation without representation. Believe me, I pay plenty of tax. And as well as that, I don't like the fact that I'm not able to contribute to life in the country that I've made my home. So I can't shape the future. And that's become increasingly important to me now I've got my little boy. So I'd like to get fully involved and I want my voting rights back. The other thing is that once I've got Italian citizenship, I can leave Italy for as long as I want and I still have the right to come back to Italy and live and work there. So although, you know, it doesn't solve the issue of taking my husband to the UK, it would solve my issue of being able to go wherever I wanted and then still be able to come back to Italy.
I think that's really interesting, Zoe, because I think it kind of, it's to do with what opportunities it opens up for you. And it's not necessarily just because of Brexit. There are other things going on there. The idea of being of politically participating in the country that you live, again, it's not, you know, in the kind of concern about the disenfranchisement of British citizens living abroad from the political process in the UK, it's not necessarily the first thing that comes to mind when people think about why people might be getting citizenship. So I think that's really interesting that for you, that's a priority. And it seems to me that it's completely in line with your, you know, your love of the EU, the experiences that you've had and your commitment actually to that European project in some way.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. And in my case, even if Brexit hadn't happened, I would have gone ahead and applied for Italian citizenship anyway, because I would also, for instance, want to vote in national elections. So, yeah, it's really important to me.
I think what's interesting when we talk about applying for citizenship is, of course, that a little bit like, you know, being subject to domestic immigration control, this is nationality law is domestic as well. So it's in the hands of the state in which you live. And I just wondered if you could tell me a little bit more about that process of applying for Italian citizenship, because I imagine it's not entirely comparable to some other cases.
No, it does differ because, as you've said, citizenship is different in each of the countries. It's a national competence, not an EU one. And in my case, I actually have favourable conditions because I'm married to an Italian man. So that means that I only have to be married for 2 years before I'm eligible to apply. And we already have been married 2 years. Well, almost, in fact. But if you have a child, then that time is cut in half anyway. So I was eligible to apply for citizenship a year after we got married. So yes, but it's not an easy process because first of all, you have to take a B1 language test to make sure that your Italian is reasonably proficient. B1, just to give people an idea, it's roughly between GCSE level and AS level for people of that generation, you know. And then you get all your paperwork in order and there's a 4-year wait before you actually get your citizenship. So yeah. Up to 4 years. You know, some people are lucky and it comes through in 2.5-3 years, but yeah, that's the processing time. You have to get criminal checks from all of the countries that you've lived in from the age of 14 So in my case, that means I also need a criminal check from Spain and a criminal check from Germany. And the real problem is that those are only valid for 6 months and they all have to be valid at the same time. At the moment, my application's on hold because COVID means that the various government offices have been closed or they've not been working as normal. So I can't guarantee getting all of these criminal checks at the same time. And then I'd have to reapply and pay the application fee again, which I don't want to do. So, but yeah, in the case of people who don't have that more favourable route, they also have to, for instance, prove that they have a minimum income level. The residency requirement is longer. So for EU citizens in Italy, it's a 4-year residency requirement. And for the Brits who were unlucky enough not to have met that 4-year residency requirement by Brexit Day, they will now have to meet a 10-year residency requirement. So this makes a massive difference to people. I've seen in so many places over social media, people just saying, oh, what's your problem? You know, if you don't like Brexit, then just take the citizenship of the country that you live in. It's really not that easy. You know, some countries, as well as a language test, they have a general knowledge test as well, which you've also got to pass. And although in some countries there are exemptions for people, for instance, who are elderly, in other countries there aren't any of those exemptions. And as you get older, it is more difficult, for instance, to learn a language or to absorb the history and politics of the country that you're living in. And even though people would like to, they just find themselves unable to do so. I'd like to give you an example of a man that I came across in Italy. Now, this man was very, very integrated into his local community, but he's unable to get citizenship. And the reason for that is that he doesn't speak Italian well at all. And that's because he lives in a German-speaking area. So every day, he lives in German, he speaks to his friends in German, he goes to work in German, but he can't manage to pass the B1 language test, so he can't have Italian citizenship. That's, you know, and I'm not criticising the Italian government at all. Please don't think I'm doing that. All I'm saying is that there are all of these people who don't necessarily fit into the box that they've got, that they need to fit into. And as a result of Brexit, that's now causing them major problems that nobody ever thought of.
I think the one common thing that comes across when you talk to people about applying for citizenship is exactly how complicated and challenging it can be for most people. So if those are the challenges for somebody who has a kind of privileged route of access to Italian citizenship through marriage, through being the parent of an Italian child, then you've only got to start to think about how much more complicated it could be for somebody who doesn't meet those criteria. And I think it's a really important reminder that it's never just a case of like showing up and saying, give me a citizenship. There are obligations related to that. There are processes that you have to go through. There are costs associated with it quite often that, you know, that actually mean that it's not that straightforward a thing to do. So thank you for kind of drawing that out and reminding people of that point. Well, finally, I just want to ask you my kind of final question, and it's the one that I've been asking everybody who's come on recently. And that's the question of myths about British people who live abroad. It seems to be that this is one of the biggest sticking points for British citizens who live in Europe. And actually in other parts of the world, is the kind of the misconceptions, the stereotypes about who they are. And I just wondered if you could just choose one myth, and I know there are many of them, which one would you choose? Which one would you choose to bust?
I think it's got to be the pensioner thing. Again, I'm not criticising pensioners. They have got the right to go and retire. Well, they have the right to retire to an EU country. And I think it's great that so many people do that. But the majority of us, we're not pensioners. We're working people, or we're even younger, and we're integrated into the community where we live. So working rights is something that have really been overlooked in many cases. And that's what I'd like people to take away from this podcast, that we're just normal people trying to earn a living.
Just not in the UK.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
I think that's a really excellent point to end on, Zoe. Thank you very much for a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast with me, Dr. Michaela Benson. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so by searching for Brexit Brits Abroad on iTunes and Libsyn. And to join in the conversation, follow us on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BrexpatsEU, and you can visit our Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. To find out more about the project, visit our brand new website, that's brexitbritsabroad.org. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.